John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. You may recall a boat trip on the Potomac River that was undertaken in solidarity with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that WSQT brought you coverage of a few weeks ago. Well, the Gaza Freedom Flotilla that the Potomac River trip was to support has been attacked in international waters by Israel. On Memorial Day, the 31st of May, Israel attacked an unarmed relief convoy bound for the besieged Gaza Strip. Aboard the largest ship to be attacked was a reporter from Al Jazeera who was able to file this report by satellite as the Israelis tried unsuccessfully to shut it down.
This is the MC Marmara. This is Hassan Ghani reporting for Press TV. We have had several injuries here. One is critical. He has been injured in the head. We think he may die if he does not receive medical treatment immediately. Another person being taken past behind in front of me right now has been seriously injured. We are being hit by tear gas, stun grenades. We have Navy ships on either side and helicopters overhead. We are being attacked from every single side. This is in international waters, not Israeli waters, not in the 68-mile exclusion zone. We are being attacked in international waters completely illegally.
This, to confirm and update you, the Israeli Navy has now boarded the Mavi Marmara, where 600 civilians have been trying to deliver aid to Gaza. Live munition has been fired. There are reports that one person has been killed. Several I have seen with my eyes have been injured. We've seen them, doctors trying to work to heal the injured. The ship remains in international water. The ship remains in international water. It's now been confirmed that one person indeed has been killed by the Israeli army, which has been using live munition on these civilians. The ships remain in international waters, yet the Israeli army, together with a helicopter, as well as naval ships, have surrounded the ship. All phones have been jammed, making it impossible to contact the outside world. They have tried to dismantle the satellite we are broadcasting from. However, this remains operational. The organizers are telling me now that they are raising a white flag. They are raising a white flag to the Israeli army. This is after one person has been killed, a civilian who was killed by munition. That number could be more. Despite the white flag being raised, Despite the white flag being raised, the Israeli army is still shooting, still firing live munitions. Jamal Al-Shayal, Al Jazeera, on board the Mavi Marmara in international waters.
إذن المتضامنون الأجانب رفعوا الراية البيضاء ورغم ذلك ما تزال النيران ما يزال رصاص الاحتلال ينهال على المتضامنين كما أن الغاز ما زال يعني قنابل الغاز ما زالت تسمع في الجهة المقابلة في الجهة الخلفية من هذه السفينة.
White flag or not, in the end 19 people at least are confirmed to have been killed by the Israelis. The Washington Post and some of their outlets are claiming 9 people, but there are other reports confirming 19 dead. In addition, you may have seen reports in the Washington Post and elsewhere that people aboard the largest ship on which casualties were taken fought back using iron bars and knives against Israeli soldiers armed with machine guns. Since the attack took place in international waters, this was legally a pirate attack. Had the convoy been armed with proper weapons, as ships expecting battle would have been, they would have had a right under international law to use these weapons. Having no weapons aboard the ship, it is being reported by the Washington Post as a way of justifying Israel's casualties that people fought back with the instruments at hand, kitchen knives and iron bars used for construction. If they did, I say kudos to them, and good for fighting back. It is also possible that these reports were a lie. Until we hear back from survivors of the attack, it is impossible to tell for sure what really happened. Indeed, let us remember those who gave their lives at the hands of Israel's pirates in international waters.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. for Monday, May 31st, 2010. At least 19 peace activists were killed as Israeli commanders attacked the Freedom Flotilla en route to Gaza to break the siege. This and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least 19 people were killed and around 50 were wounded when an Israeli commando force forcefully boarded the boats and randomly opened fire at the peace activists who were en route to the Gaza Strip. The activists were hoping to deliver much-needed supplies to the besieged Gaza residents, including construction material, medical supplies, in addition to 100 pre-manufactured houses, in addition to 500 electric wheelchairs. The Israeli military claimed their forces were attacked first, an allegation strongly denied by the activists on board. The attack started after the army forcefully boarded the Turkish-flagged boat and opened fire at the passengers before hundreds of commandos attacked all ships at once, assuming control over them, and trailed them to Ashdod Airport. However, their fate remains unknown. Among the wounded were Sheikh Ra'ed Salah, head of the northern branch of the Islamic movement in Israel, who suffered serious wounds, and head of the Lebanese delegation, Hani Suleiman, in addition to the captain of the Marmara Turkish ship and a Turkish legislator. Media sources reported that the Greek captain of the boat 8000 was wounded and refused to receive medical aid in Israel and demanded to be transported to his country. In the aftermath of the attack, Israel beefed up its police in the Arab town of Umm al-Fahm, the hometown of Sheikh Ra'ed Salah. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office cancelled his visit to the United States, where he was supposed to meet with the U.S. President Barack Obama in Washington. In the meantime, the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose country has the highest losses among the victims, interrupted his visit to Latin America and headed back to his country. Erdogan is expected to come up with harsh statements against Israel once he's back, as his initial comment described the attack as, quote, state terrorism, end quote, and Turkey called the Israeli ambassador and delivered a letter of condemnation to Israel and cancelled 3 military joint drills with Israel and recalled their envoy in Tel Aviv. Thousands of people in Turkey protested in front of the Israeli consulate in Istanbul and the embassy in Ankara, demanding their government to sever the diplomatic relations with Israel. On the other hand, the American and French reactions were very mild. While Washington expressed sorrow for the victims, the French President Nicolas Sarkozy said he is sorry for this, quote, disproportionate use of force, end quote. In Palestine, people took to the streets in several areas in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to protest the Israeli attack on the peace activists, and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas declared a three-day mourning in the country. A number of European countries, including Greece, Spain, and Sweden, called the Israeli ambassador to express their condemnation to the Israeli raid. In other news, a Palestinian woman died of wounds suffered when a settler hit her with his car on Sunday, Palestinian medical sources in Hebron reported. Fatma Sabarna, 55, was seriously injured after the car hit her. The settler fled the scene. Local sources reported that the woman and her husband were walking near the Beit Umar graveyard on the Hebron-Jerusalem road when they were rammed by the settler. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. For constant update, please visit our website. This report has been brought to you by George Schmel.
On what we know as Memorial Day in the U.S., the Navy of Israel ordered a convoy of relief ships for the besieged Gaza Strip by armed force. 19 people are confirmed dead at the hands of Israel's seagoing pirates. Since the attack occurred in international waters, 20 miles outside the waters claimed by Israel, it is in fact an act of piracy, meaning the Gaza relief convoy would have been entitled to resist the attack with armed force if they had had weapons, but they did not. Outraged at this deadly attack and the detention of everyone aboard ships which were towed to Israel, an estimated 200 people protested at the Israeli embassy and later at the White House, demanding that the United States cease and desist sending aid to Israel. Some demanded a complete severance of diplomatic relations with its terrorist pirates' den. Others simply remembered 19 heroes killed by Israeli murderers.
Been towed.
Well, the protests here in Washington, D.C. against Israel's pirate attack on the Gaza aid convoy were relatively restrained. Protests in Turkey, which had hundreds of citizens aboard the ships, were not so restrained. And about 5 a.m. on the 31st of May, people in Turkey tried to storm an Israeli consulate, furious about the deaths of their countrymen at Israel's hands.
It's quite noisy here, so I'm not sure if I could hear your question, but I'll just give you an update from Turkey. I'm standing outside the Israeli consulate, and there are hundreds of people here gathered in protest and in prayer for the news that from the Israeli television is reporting that at least 16 people have been killed, and hundreds of protesters have been here overnight. They gathered here at around 12 o'clock last night, as soon as we heard that the Israeli military were following the convoy in the Mediterranean Sea. It's quite calm here now, although it's quite noisy, as you can probably hear. But it wasn't quite the same earlier this morning. If I can just get my cameraman to direct the picture to the building that houses the Israeli consulate. At about 5 a.m. this morning, protesters stormed the consulate building. They were it was an angry reaction to the news that there were deaths on board the convoy, and you can see that the glass has been broken. There are police now protecting the building, and this, as I said, happened at around 5 a.m. this morning. This was an angry reaction from the Turkish streets here towards the intervention by the Israeli military on the humanitarian aid convoy traveling to Gaza.
And once again, that was an attack that constituted piracy because it took place against civilian vessels in international waters. It is an attack that organizers of the flotilla say killed 19 people. 19 people confirmed dead by the organizers. The Washington Post only admits to 9. The Washington Post also claims the people in the flotilla fought back with knives, iron bars, and pepper spray, with the instruments at hand since the vessels were unarmed, since there were no proper weapons on board. If this is true, and we don't know if the Washington Post is telling the truth or lying until survivors get back, then under international law, they were entitled to use force against a pirate attack. If these reports are false and they died without resistance, either way, the 19 people who Israel killed died with honor defending the people of Gaza against pirates from the State of Israel. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Shortly before Memorial Day weekend, the D.C. Council tried to have a closed breakfast, only to have this closed breakfast raided by community members who were furious about budget cuts and the refusal to tax the rich, who have done very well under Mayor Fenney, to pay for services needed by the poor, who Mayor Fenney has harmed greatly.
Your name? Burke Sandsbury. We're here in the Wilson Building. We're heading on up to the breakfast briefing where the council members right now are talking about the budget vote today. We're gonna be busting into the room, and we're going to tell them to do the math. We're going to tell them no more subtraction. We need addition. We need you to add money back into the budget by raising taxes so that we can save our safety net. We're going in right now.
What are you all doing?
We know someone in here can propose an amendment. We can have new tax income brackets, and we can fund the safety net.
Thousands of people have come out in support of this proposal to raise taxes. Some of those people are people like me who would be taxed under this program. We want new taxes. It's the only way to save the safety net.
5% increase on people making over $20,000. The math you guys have does not make sense. We have a bag tax. We have a soda tax. This affects the least of us the most. Why won't you tax the people who can afford to pay it?
If I can leave $10 on the table to save our safety net, so can you. We have to take care of ourselves.
Chairman Gray, you can make this happen. Where are you going? You can be the sensible leader we need.
Don't run away from this. This problem's not going away. As a person, who has experienced homelessness in the past, you risk me becoming homeless again and possibly dying out on the street. And you're also threatening our mental health services.
There's still time.
You're showing how morally and spiritually bankrupt you folks are. I don't know how you could look at yourself and not be.
Stop the cuts. Show some guts. Stop the cuts. Show some guts.
And how could you have high wage earners not be taxed more money?
Chairman Gray.
Chairman Gray. How many cuts have you made today? Chairman Gray. Chairman Gray. How many cuts have you made today?
Councilwoman Yvette Alexander, what are your thoughts here in the briefing breakfast room?
I love democracy in action, and we have saved some of the components of the safety net. So, Councilmember Brown, you can count on him to introduce an amendment for that. Okay.
Do you understand?
But you guys are great. Do I understand? Of course we understand. This is just as hard for us as it is for everyone else. We work for you.
And how can any of you talk about being spiritual people and going to church every weekend and watch people suffer?
It's bad.
Councilmember Wells, it's just like saving the Anacostia. We have to save the people who live there in the city, not just the river, the people who live here. It's just as important as any other bill that you've passed.
Joni Pochin.
We have to put the neighbor back in hood again. The neighbor back in hood.
Joni Pochin, can you describe what's taking place?
We have Save Our Safety Net protesters asking the council to introduce the solution to our safety net cuts that are on the table, a progressive income tax increase.
Today, to raise taxes on high income earners, that's the only way we're going to do it.
That's right.
Can one of you commit to doing that today in the
council chamber? The top 5% of the city.
We need an amendment.
The top 5% of the city.
Chairman Gray's not going to do it.
Can we make a point? You make a point.
This is an election year. It is important.
How can any of you consciously allow other breaks from high wage earners into the city and not help us poor people?
Have to do what's doing what's right.
You guys, can you leave us so we can ask?
We'll leave if you all will agree to introduce an amendment. Who's going to introduce the amendment? We'll be out of here.
So election year is because we can't do what's right.
This is serious. People are going to be homeless. People are going to have to die. Into the foster care system. Look.
Because we want us to listen to us.
More than 800 families will be at risk of homelessness.
Well, you're not respecting any of us.
More. We already have.
You just left. You just turned away from the
kids. You're not listening.
No, I just heard that. You guys. Yeah, but this is disrespectful to not tax these people who earn more money.
We just want to know
because we're going to suffer, we're going to die out.
Look, we need addition in the city. We can't take any more subtraction. That's why we're trying to help you all do the math. You can't save a safety net by shifting around funds. We need new revenue. And the soda tax isn't going to cut it. Y'all know that. Like, we all have done the numbers.
I mean, you have so many people in here that make well over anything we make. Why not tax them more money?
It's on high-income people. Soda tax is regressive. It's only going to affect working class and low-income people the hardest. It's great, so we don't need to drink much soda. That's great. Healthy schools are great. We need a progressive revenue increase. It's a no-brainer.
Progressive income tax, Mr. Evans.
You don't think Jack Evans is in favor of progressive income tax? Come on, Freeman.
Jack Evans has never been in favor of anything progressive. His allegiance lies to his constituents, who are the top 5%, and that's whose interests they are serving. That is the only reason why the issue of being our election year is even a barricade to doing what's right, because they are beholden to the people who are their funders, their donors, and that is who they don't want to disrespect. They're disrespecting 99% of the city because the poorest people are not electorally involved with the process, because they have jobs and don't have the mental space to participate in a corrupt system that's beholden to the plurocracy that's governing this body. And that is what this is all about. We need a 1% progressive income tax on the top 5% in the city. Or people make over $200,000, 1% additional, we're creating $25 million to cover any of the cuts that they're proposing. It doesn't have to happen. But they're doing regressive politics like soda tax that's affecting the poorest people in the city. It doesn't make any sense. And that's why we're here, to make sure that they know that math does not add up We need addition, not subtraction.
Yes, Councilmember, Ward 7, Councilmember Yvette Alexander.
The mayor. You always address the council. The mayor proposed the budget. You all don't put the pressure on the mayor that you need to put on.
You're asking
what?
Is allowed to the council controls a lot of the crap the mayor does.
No, you all don't put the pressure on the mayor. We're accessible. We're approachable. We're here for the people.
No, but why aren't you putting a leash on him?
Why aren't you putting the pressure on the mayor? No,
well, we don't have to vote for none of you, really.
It's not the question of that.
You know, because we pay your paycheck.
So you're
certainly have. I have done it in person.
What's the bullpen?
The mayor's office. You know what the bullpen is. You should have taken it to the bullpen in January.
Do the math. They think, they say that what they can do is piece together the safety net that we need without progressive revenue. We know that's wrong.
Right.
The solution to this problem, the solution to the problem of 22.5 million in cuts is 22.5 million in progressive revenue. We need to go to the D.C. residents who have suffered the least in this recession. They're ready to pay their fair share so that we can have a strong city, so that we can have healthy communities without disability assistance, without homeless shelters, without affordable housing. We can't have the city that we all want and need. That's what we're here to do today. Show them the math. We're here to help them. We've got accountants out. We've got mathematicians out. We have regular people like me who just took high school math. We can do this. If we can do this, if we can add up these numbers and figure this out, so can they. Thank you for coming out to help them do the math today. This is important. We're about to see what they end up doing. Let's hope that they do more addition than they do subtraction today.
Councilmember Michael Brown, you were in the breakfast briefing that was taken over by Save Our Safety Net and activists who are concerned about the safety net. You've been at the forefront of considering putting forward legislation. Talk about where things stand and your thoughts about this morning.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to see what you did. That's what democracy is all about. And it helped me because I don't think my colleagues have heard me enough. So what you did this morning, frankly, helped me immensely. I don't think it's going to change the outcome of the tax piece. But we were very successful, as you know, restoring a lot of those safety net issues and concerns. Maybe not completely restoration, but a lot of restoration that I think will, at least when people wake up on October 1st, will not devastate this city, especially the poorer folks in our city.
What's stopping some of your colleagues, Ward 2 Councilmember Jack Evans, David Catania, and a few others, from hearing that there are real needs in this city?
Because I think there's a belief that there aren't a lot of poor folks in our city anymore. And that to me is shocking and amazing, especially when we have 25,000 more families on food stamps. We have doubled our homeless population. We're turning people away from DC General. We have job training programs that cannot even meet the need relative to the unemployment numbers. So I don't know the answer to that question. All I think is maybe it's an election year. That's the only thing I can think of. But I don't know why you wouldn't want to help people in need during an election year. That's what doesn't make sense to me.
That's what I can't understand. It's an election year. You think you need the votes. And a rich person's vote counts the same as poor people. And in D.C., there's a lot more of us who are poor than those of us who are rich.
I agree. That's why I've been fighting for it. Hey, hair looks nice. Your hair looks very nice. I agree with you. I don't have the answer. But I'm not going to stop fighting, though.
And what's the so are you going to put forward your legislation today that will call for a tax increase on the wealthiest district earners?
I'm not sure. I mean, we did so much work over the last few days to get the restorations done. But I'm going to make a strong statement about it, because we can revisit this later this year and definitely next year. So whether I do it today or not really doesn't make any difference, because we don't have the votes, A. And B, I already got some of the restorations done. So the point is, next year we're going to be back here with the same problem. and I hope that my colleagues take a different look at it.
Lastly, Michael Brown, just on that point of not bringing the legislation up in an election year, if you do bring it up, then people will say yes or no, where does Chairman Gray, who is running for mayor against Fenty, who many have criticized as being too concerned about the needs of the wealthiest, and Chairman Gray has a chance to distinguish himself here, but if you don't put forward your bill, then we won't really know where he stands.
And Jim Graham may bring it up. The problem is he and I didn't really agree on the tax rate. I wanted to make it lower, down to about $200,000 or $250,000. Jim was at $500,000. I didn't think that brought us enough revenue.
Explain that. So you wanted to start the increasing tax?
I wanted to start a little lower at about $250,000. Jim wanted to do $500,000. And to me, the $500,000 wasn't enough. It didn't really bring in enough revenue to do what we needed to do on the safety net issues. So I'm not prepared to bring mine up, but if Jim brings his up, I'll support him, but we're not going to have the votes to get it done. The good thing is we got the restorations done.
Thanks so much, Councilman Michael Brown.
Mr. Brown, what's going to happen today?
On the 29th of May, protesters gathered in DuPont Circle and marched on the White House with a dual demand. Stop Arizona's racist SB 1070 program and keep ICE's so-called secure communities enforcement program out of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
All right, give it up for Wendy Ramirez, y'all.
For you today, as an advocate for civil rights and immigrant rights of the Equal Rights Center, as a D.C. resident, and most personally as a Latina immigrant, as clearly demonstrated, the increasing polarization debate of immigration reform that resulted in laws being introduced and passed from coast to coast that often lead to civil rights violations, racial profiling, and the isolation of immigrant communities. Formal programs like 287G, CAP, Secure Communities, and other ICE access programs that utilize state and local criminal justice systems to enforce civil immigration law, along with informal local enforcements of similar of federal immigration law, have resulted in unlawful detentions, pretextual arrests of people who the police perceive to be quote-unquote foreign, including citizens and lawful permanent residents in order to check immigration status. Programs like these that give the power of immigration enforcement to the hands of local enforcement is what opens the floodgates to laws like SB 1070. Immigration enforcement should be the sole responsibility of the federal government. In November, the D.C. Chief of Police, Kathy Lanier, signed a memorandum of agreement with ICE to bring the so-called Secure Communities or Unsecure Communities program to our city. In a snapshot, secure communities can lead to racial profiling by police officers, a compromise to the community policing strategies that DCMPD has worked hard towards establishing. Our immigrant communities can live in fear of calling 911 when they witness a crime or when they themselves become victims of crime, and families ultimately could be torn apart. Secure communities have been implemented, not yet in D.C., thanks to the leadership and advocacy work of a coalition of local and national organizations that have been working around the clock, as you can see here today, to make sure that D.C. Council and our Chief of Police are aware of the compromise that programs like Secure Communities can have on the civil rights of immigrants and non-immigrants in our city. Successfully in May, D.C. Council unanimously introduced the Secure Communities Act of 2010. No. This is actually to ban secure communities. Yeah. The name is deceiving, actually. But what it means is that it would prohibit DCMPD from sending any booking information to ICE. DC would be one of the first jurisdictions in all of the United States to say no to secure communities and no to racial profiling of immigrants and yes to preserving the civil rights of all individuals in our city. In closing, I want to point out that it's not about amending programs like secure communities. It's about ending these programs that pave the way to laws like SB 1070. No more SB 1070! No more SB 1070! No more SB 1070! Thank you. Gracias.
And here's DC's own Reverend Hagler speaking about this whole Arizona mess.
There's something that we need to understand is that in the state of Arizona, things like this have been a historical pattern. It's nothing new. I know what justice looks like. I don't care what any other politician says. You know what justice looks like. Yeah, don't worry about what somebody says when they talk about you about being reasonable. Say, I know what's in my heart. I know my passion. I know the feeling of justice, and therefore, I'm going to hold out until justice comes. Continue on until justice rolls down like water.
You heard that? And if you don't like the racist swill flowing from the Arizona government, there's something you can do about it. And that is to boycott any products manufactured in Arizona and don't travel to Arizona. Don't spend any money there for any way, shape, or reason. Boycott Arizona and boycott hate. On the 27th of May, protesters arrived at the D.C. law offices of Crowell and Mooring, LLP, at 10th and Pennsylvania Avenue. This law firm is representing Pacific Rim, a mining corporation which has been prevented from strip mining for gold in El Salvador and poisoning an entire village. Now, they are suing the government of El Salvador for lost profits and using the same law firm as Blackwater to do so. That's right, the same scumbags Blackwater goes to when they need mercenaries of their own.
What are we here for, citizens? 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 What are we here for, citizens?
Many of the protesters displayed empty suits and ties without people in them as a symbol that the lawsuit against the government of El Salvador is also an empty suit.
The most devastating impact.
En la industria minera hoy se necesita y se hace 79 toneladas de tierra destruida para conseguir una onza de oro. Y este no es el bloqueo.
One of the most devastating impacts of gold comes from the fact that you don't find gold buried amongst benign rock waste. Gold is found amongst lead, cadmium, arsenic, and sulfides, and many other toxic metals. And once you grind that ore body to a powder fine consistency and drench it in cyanide solution, which is, you know, the modern day process, when those sulfides turn into sulfuric acid, and that accelerates the leaching process of all the heavy metals so it contaminates both air and water.
Okay, hay un proceso muy técnico que no puedo explicar ni interpretar, pero es que no se puede encontrar el oro en las tierras neutrales o sanas. Es que son en rocas en piedras que contienen metálicas muy tóxico. Y para extraer el oro tiene que romper esta piedra hacia un polvo y después meterlo en agua que tiene una cantidad enorme de cianuro para extraer el oro.
And so effectively, every gold mine turns a mountain or a lake bed into a heap of leaching toxins that will leach toxins for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
En El Salvador se ha venido librando una batalla de información contra una campaña de desinformación que ha venido impulsando la empresa minera Pacific Rim. Una de esas es la denominada campaña de la minería verde que ya todos ustedes conocen.
So we've been waging the battle of ideas to bring information against a war of disinformation. A campaign of disinformation that Pacific Rim has brought on our communities, the so-called Green Mining Campaign.
Campaña que ha sido posible por muchas personas humildes de las comunidades que habitan en cada uno de los rincones de El Salvador, que hoy en día realmente tiene un posicionamiento tanto a nivel de iglesias, a nivel de gobierno, no solo de derecha, sino también con los gobiernos de izquierda que hoy tenemos. Realmente ha sido una ardua tarea de la población civil de informar sobre los impactos que genera la actividad minera en El Salvador. y que está generando y hemos visto en otros lugares del mundo, como en Valle de Siria, Honduras.
So the battle on our side is being waged by humble people from across El Salvador who are in every part of the country, who've been educating themselves and the rest of their country, men and women, about this. And this, as now this has reached the levels of the church, the Catholic Church, of the government, not only the right-wing government, but the left-wing government that we now have in power in El Salvador. And it's been similar to the kind of information that we need to bring to people, that we have been bringing to people, comes from places like the Syria Valley in Honduras.
Efectos que vimos y que realmente no queremos para El Salvador. Esto ha elevado realmente a tener y que cada uno de los salvadoreños demos algún benedicto de juicio sobre lo que es la minería ahí en El Salvador y lo que queremos para nuestros hijos, lo que queremos para que sea el futuro de El Salvador, un país que sea amigable con el medio ambiente y no un país destruido por las empresas mineras que hoy extorsionan a El Salvador.
The information that we have is about what kind of environmental destruction this mining causes. And this has really informed our ability to speak out and say what we want for our lives, what we want for our children's lives, what we want for our future, the future of El Salvador, which is a country that is in harmony with nature, a country that is in harmony with nature, not a country that has been destroyed by these mining companies that now are extorting the government of El Salvador.
Extorsionan a El Salvador valiéndose de instrumentos como los tratados de libre comercio, utilizando también empresas y firmas inescrupulosas que hoy llevan adelante un proceso de demanda ante el CIADI aquí en Washington.
En Pacific Rim, this mining company, they're now trying to take advantage of the free trade agreement with the United States, but they also employ unscrupulous firms and lawyers like the ones residing here in this building of Crowley & Loring to put forward this lawsuit at the World Bank, the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes at the World Bank right here in Washington.
The protest against Pacific Rim, a Canadian mining company, and their lawyers, the same lawyers Blackwater uses for suing El Salvador, included a sarcastic street skit where someone on stilts posing as a PR flack for Pacific Rim argued against the people of El Salvador about what was right for their country.
Pacific Rim has only the interest of the poor, suffering multitudes.
Order!
We want to bring benefits to their community. We have invested in their community infrastructure. We have repaired buildings. We have invested in their schools and their churches.
For who?
Community development. They're very glad to have Pacific Rim.
The children of San Miguel Ixhuacan living in the houses that are falling apart over their heads because of the explosions in the mine get sick and have rashes on their bodies and can't sleep at night and die for inexplicable reasons. You tell their families it's because they're unhygienic.
We know nothing about any violence organized against the anti-mining activists. It's just a coincidence.
Now why are you looking for Blackwater's people?
When Pacific Rim got involved, poverty often breeds violence, and that's why we're here in Guantanamo.
You're damn right, poverty breeds violence. Five people in El Salvador gave their lives to stop Pacific Rim's mine from poisoning their village. Now Pacific Rim, in a snit, turns to the mercenaries Blackwater uses in court. Try and get back there.
Matt,
profits before Kangaroo Court, run by the World Bank. On the 28th of May, security at four DC customers of puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences got caught with their pants down as protesters stormed the buildings housing Novartis and AstraZeneca at 701 Pennsylvania Avenue, Sanofi Venice at 801 Pennsylvania Avenue, and Bristol-Myers Squibb off 15th Street. Even though an undercover car with Virginia tags was seen shadowing the protests, it looks like the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force didn't share their intelligence with security in the buildings, and here's what it sounded like inside. Couldn't even properly record the audio inside the buildings. That's a lot of noise to be hammering downtown office buildings with. In addition to this disruption, Sanofi of Venice at 801 Pennsylvania Avenue suffered the additional indignity of being called out for their role as a member of the IG Farben conglomerate during World War II. You may remember IG Farben. They were the guys that made Zyklon B for the Nazis.
IG Farben was the company that manufactured Zyklon B for the SS, for Auschwitz.
And these guys were involved with them?
They were at the time. They came, it was a conglomerate. They all came together, all the companies, all the animal testing companies, and all the pharmaceutical companies came together during World War II under the Nazi regime.
And they made things like Zyklon B?
Yes, they made Zyklon B. They were corrupt. Then after the war, all those people involved with the production of Zyklon B and involved with the slave labor camps and Nazi death camps were fired. Word said, get out of here, we don't want you anymore.
You should have been hanged.
Some of them went to jail and then were hired right back on to the company. Right after they had just worked with the Nazis.
You heard that? When it comes to Sanofi of Venice, apparently doing business with puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, where seven undercover investigators caught researchers punching beagle puppies in the face and dissecting live monkeys is not enough. Their history in World War II as part of IG Farben, the makers of Zyklon B, shows the true nature of Sanofi of Venice and why you should think twice about buying any drugs manufactured by Sanofi of Venice. And Sanofi of Venice, if you don't stop doing business with animal torturers, people are just gonna just keep digging, and more dirty secrets like this IG Farben connection are gonna keep coming out. Because in DC there's no sleep for the wicked.
One shovel, one fight,
human freedom, human rights.
On the 26th of May, protesters descended on the Austrian embassy in Washington, D.C., demanding an end to legal persecution of animal rights activists in that country.
Once again, Austria, the reason we are outside of your embassy on the afternoon of May 26th is because we are taking part in a global campaign called Shame on Austria. Since 2008, 14 of your activists, Austria, have been on trial for doing nothing more than legal nonprofit work and performing an above-ground non-government organization, or NGO. Three of these activists, Austria, were held for 3 months in 2008 with no charges whatsoever. And six of these activists are still being charged for nothing more than legal work
The protest ended with the delivery of a letter to the Austrian embassy demanding that charges such as belonging to a criminal organization for peaceful NGO work be dropped.
Hello? Hi, my name is and I'm here to deliver a letter, and I talked to Mr. Wolfgang and then
everyone for the
Ministry
of Justice. Yeah.
He said, okay.
You heard that, Austria. Drop the charges.
Faced with multiple cases of environmental abuses by British Petroleum, the Environmental Protection Agency has suspended negotiations over whether to bar the oil company from federal contracts in the Gulf of Mexico, which could cost BP billions of dollars. Since their oil platform exploded on April the 20th, BP has failed to stop the massive oil rupture from a deep underwater well that is now creating a massive oil slick that is polluting the shoreline of the Gulf Coast from Louisiana to Florida. According to ProPublica, the EPA issued a recent statement claiming that the agency is examining BP's overall record in the Gulf of Mexico, the frequency and patterns of incidents, its corporate culture, and recent changes in policies and procedures. The most severe type of sanction against BP is known as discretionary debarment, which would force BP to cancel its oil contracts with the Pentagon, as well as preventing BP from securing new oil leases or renewing its current oil leases with the federal government. The EPA's negotiations with BP were strained before the April destruction of the company's Deepwater Horizon oil rig.
In Richmond, Virginia, on the 18th of May, Massey Energy, the coal company known for the West Virginia mine disaster and for mountaintop removal mining, held their annual AGM meeting. Two activists were arrested for dropping a banner inside reading, "Massey, stop putting profits over people," while others disrupted the event, the group occupying the adjacent rotunda. Meanwhile, hundreds of mining union and environmental activists held separate rallies outside, both denouncing Massey's criminal carelessness in the mines, with both worker safety and that of the surrounding communities and natural environments. Here's what someone from one of the organizations involved in the protest had to say. What happened at Massey's AGM yesterday?
Well, yesterday, two protesters were arrested unfurling a banner inside the hotel, which was the site of the Massey Energy stockholders meeting. The banner said, "Massey, stop putting profits over people." And these two brave souls were basically pointing out that Massey needs to stop its process of mountaintop removal coal mining. Coal mining is dangerous. It's dangerous for communities in Central Appalachia. It's dangerous for future generations. And of course, as we've seen from the incredibly horrific blast that actually recently killed 29 coal miners, it's extremely dangerous for miners themselves.
So there were two people arrested, right?
Right. There were two people arrested. They were, at the time of their arrest, they were unfurling that 10x10 banner that said, "Massey, stop putting profits over people." And they were also reading an open letter, which actually was from them to Massey Energy, basically stating the reasons that they were doing that and the reasons that Massey Energy should stop and cease and desist its practice of mountaintop removal coal mining.
I saw that the banner did get fully deployed.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Simply that, you know, mountaintop removal coal mining is an extremely destructive practice that is destroying the water quality in Central Appalachia. It is creating dangerous flood conditions in Central Appalachia. And furthermore, it doesn't even create many jobs. So mountaintop removal coal mining is a practice that very much needs to end. And we think that Massey Energy should cease and desist their coal mining activities in terms of mountaintop removal coal mining. Already 500 mountains have been leveled by the practice of mountaintop removal coal mining. How many more mountains have to disappear and how many more people have to die?
There is a reason some have called coal and oil, which come from under the ground, energy from hell. These fuels are rapidly turning into high-priced unobtainium anyway. So the sooner we all transition to renewable energy, termed energy from heaven, because wind and solar come from the sky, the better.
The worst mining disaster in 40 years took place at a mine owned by Massey Energy in southern West Virginia, where 29 miners were killed on April 5th. In just the past 4 years, Massey has been cited for more than 500 health and safety violations in its mines by federal inspectors, who also stated that 90 of them were deemed significant and due to the company's reckless disregard for the safety of its workers. Under CEO Don Blankenship, Massey has challenged almost every single violation, delaying implementation of necessary changes. In the wake of the Massey mine explosion, the Obama administration has launched a civil investigation to better understand what happened and to put in place procedures to prevent a repeat of similar disasters in the future. The FBI is also conducting a criminal investigation. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rena Steinzer, a professor at the University of Maryland Law School and president of the Center for Progressive Reform, a virtual think tank of 50 experts around the country who focus on issues of the environment, health, and safety. She explains the precedents for holding company executives criminally liable in fatal accidents and why she supports prosecuting Don Blankenship personally for the deaths of the West Virginia miners.
A criminal investigation of a mining disaster is relatively unusual. This company, Massey Energy, was investigated in the past at Arakoma, and as I understand it, they were fined. But that's the company, not the people, the individuals. I think there is far too little criminal prosecution of executives. And that was that's a point that I've been making as often as I can.
Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances under which an executive of a company could be held criminally liable for a fatal accident, such as the one that occurred at the Upper Big Branch mine?
In the health, safety, and environment area, there is a doctrine that was created by the Supreme Court. It's called the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine. And it says, in essence, if you're in a position in a company to do something about a problem that is very dangerous, that could cause either extensive damage to the environment or hurt people, then you can be held criminally liable, even if you didn't carry out the activities that caused the problem yourself. If you were in a position to avoid or prevent the problem, you're criminally liable. And that's a doctrine that is not used often enough.
Rena Steinzer, do you know of any examples where the head of a company was held criminally liable and maybe spent any time in prison?
First of all, the two Supreme Court cases that I was discussing, one involved shipment of adulterated drugs. That was back in 1943. The second involved rodent infestation of a food warehouse. There also was a case in Maryland where civilian employees at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds buried hazardous waste on the Army's property, and they were prosecuted criminally and did serve brief jail terms, I believe.
Since the accident, we've all heard how Massey Energy, under Don Blankenship's leadership, has been cited for hundreds of serious health and safety violations. Do you think he's a good candidate for criminal prosecution?
Yes, I think Blankenship is a very good candidate for criminal prosecution because he created a culture where workers were afraid that they would be fired if they paid attention to safety precautions. The mine was evacuated several times before the fatal explosion, and yet Blankenship refused, despite this obvious indication that something was seriously wrong. He refused to address these problems. As you mentioned, he was cited hundreds, thousands, if you go back far enough times, for serious violations, serious problems, and fought every single one of them. This is not a company under his leadership, and he was personally involved in a lot of these episodes, that had demonstrated any concern for worker safety. And in my view, if you don't prosecute chief executive officers in those circumstances, you dilute the message and you create a circumstance where the company will be given a monetary fine and will go back to its bad old ways, because too often the fine is not even the amount that they saved by violating the law.
The FBI is doing the criminal investigation, but Joe Maine, the new head of MSHA, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, is also investigating the accident for the Obama administration. What kind of job do you think he's doing?
I think Joe Maine is trying to make the best use he can of the resources that he has, but MSHA is painfully underfunded and has survived in a culture where the career people are badgered and dissuaded from doing an aggressive job. Too often we find that career civil servants have sort of a muscle memory of the Bush administration, and it takes a lot of aggressive leadership to change that perception. And I think that the Obama appointees in these top jobs are trying very hard to change that culture. Unfortunately, they haven't yet received enough money to give their agencies the kind of muscle that they need. And we're not talking about huge sums. We're talking about even tens of millions of dollars, which is a very small amount in comparison to the harm that's caused by these incidents, would make them much more present. They'd have more inspectors. They'd be more aggressive. They'd have better lawyers. And they would clean up this industry a lot quicker.
That was Rena Steinzer of the Center for Progressive Reform. Contact the center at area code 410-706-0564 or visit the group's website at progressivereform.org.